This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, the 3rd of August, 2007. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Mexican Special Forces step up operations in Oaxaca as a high-level delegation urges the Mexican government to take action against political violence. We'll hear from Baghdad, where Iraq's oil minister invokes a Saddam-era law declaring the oil workers' union illegal. And we'll hear about the first GLBT leaders' picks for the 08 presidential elections on this week's political roundup. All that and more, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. Devastating floods fed by monsoon rains have displaced around 20 million people across South Asia. More than 1,100 people have been confirmed dead in India, Bangladesh, Nepal, and Pakistan, but that number is expected to rise sharply once floodwaters recede and rescue efforts begin in full. Farmland across the subcontinent is underwater. The United Nations is calling it the worst flooding in living memory. Members of a regional coalition of U.S. state and Canadian provincial governments are holding 3 days of meetings in Vancouver to discuss measures to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Mark Taylor Canfield has more.
Officials from six U.S. states and two Canadian provinces are meeting to formulate a regional greenhouse gas reduction and to agree on a formula for calculating carbon emissions. Western Climate Initiative representatives will also discuss plans to create a carbon emission trading market between U.S. states and provincial governments in Canada. The Western Climate Initiative formed in February when governors from Washington, Oregon, California, Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico agreed to set common goals for reducing carbon emissions. Governors say the regional coalition came as a result of the federal government's failure to address the problem of global warming. Washington State Governor Christine Gregoire campaigned to include Canada in the initiative, and the provincial governors of Manitoba and British Columbia signed on as a result. Representatives from the industrialized and highly populated province of Ontario are present at the Vancouver meeting as observers. This is Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle for Free Speech Radio News.
Nigeria's Nuclear Regulatory Authority warns that the West African nation is at risk of serious environmental contamination due to radioactive materials dumped in abandoned oil wells. Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
A new report by Nigeria's Nuclear Regulatory Agency charges that multinational oil companies operating in the Niger Delta region have repeatedly abandoned radioactive materials in their oil wells after using them for exploration studies. The oil companies are also known to lose radioactive materials even before using them. Apart from the environmental impact that can result from the unsafe handling or disposal of radioactive materials, there is also a significant security risk created when such materials go missing. Nigeria's Nuclear Regulatory Agency is expected to develop and enact tougher regulations in the next 2 months that will punish oil companies that carelessly handle radioactive materials. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
Bay Area police are investigating yesterday's murder of a prominent black journalist in Oakland. Oakland Post editor Chauncey Bailey was shot dead yesterday near the Alameda County Courthouse. Police arrested 19 people in a series of pre-dawn raids today. One of the locations raided was a black Muslim bakery, which had been the subject of investigative coverage by Chauncey Bailey. Police would not comment if the raid was tied to the murder investigation. Thousands of British military personnel are facing escalating mental health problems, alcoholism, and family breakdown as a result of post-traumatic stress from serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
The King's College London Military Health Centre's report published today has confirmed fears about Britain's overstretched military. The maximum time recommended for troops to serve on the front line overseas is 13 months within a 3-year period. But Britain's current commitments mean that some military personnel are serving over the recommended time limit for active service. Many are also left uncertain of the length of their service overseas. These factors were found to cause serious stress conditions among military personnel. Barry Mannon is a soldier currently suing the Ministry of Defence over his mental health after serving extended tours of duty.
It's proven what campaigners have known about for a very long time, that the longer you're in a war zone, the more susceptible you are, your body's going to break down, your mind's going to break down as well, and basically at that point you become useless as a soldier.
Britain's deployed mental health specialists to treat soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
The opposition of Iraq's Southern Oil Workers Union to that country's proposed oil law has earned it the ire of Iraq's oil minister. FSRN's David Enders reports from Iraq, where the oil minister invoked a Saddam Hussein-era law and declared the union illegal last week.
Hussein Shahristani, the oil minister, says he sees no irony in that the law is one of the few Saddam-era laws dealing with trade and economics not repealed by the Coalition Provisional Authority, the unelected body that ruled Iraq in the year following the invasion.
By the way, most of the laws under Saddam are the laws of the country that are still followed, so this is not an exception. Any law has to be amended by the parliament or replaced before it becomes binding. So all the previous laws are still binding unless they are amended or replaced. That particular law was reinstated by the CPA. So even after the fall of the regime, that was the law.
The Southern Oil Workers Union, which represents 10 unions in southern Iraq, links the timing of Shahristani's announcement to their continued opposition to the oil law currently proposed by the cabinet of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. As the head of a ministry, Shahristani sits on the cabinet and has voiced his support for the law, which those opposed say will allow foreign oil companies unprecedented access to Iraq's fields and distribute oil wealth unevenly around the country. Falah Aboud is the union's general secretary.
He called us spoilers of the oil ministry. He's just trying to carry out the American policies in Iraq.
The union dates back to the 1930s and was reorganized in the months following the fall of Hussein's government. Since the invasion, it has been one of the only bodies in Iraq able to enforce its will through nonviolence, organizing demonstrations and brief strikes that have garnered higher wages for its members. The union has been working tirelessly to have the proposed law changed before it is voted on, meeting with various political parties and the Prime Minister. Aboud again.
I'm very optimistic. The oil law will not pass.
In the fight over the current draft law, the union is well supported. Aside from al-Maliki's cabinet and the U.S. government's closest Shiite political ally, the Supreme Iraqi Islamic Council, no major Iraqi political bloc is in support of the current draft, which has been tabled at least until the Iraqi parliament returns from its summer recess in September. The U.S.'s other close allies in the country, the two Kurdish political parties that rule the semi-independent northern part of the country, have rejected the current draft of the law because they do not see it as favorable enough to their aspirations of greater autonomy. The current draft places all future oil deals in the hands of a federal council led by the prime minister. The Kurds would like their regional government in the north to be able to sign its own oil deals with foreign companies. Mahmoud Othman is a Kurdish politician who has represented the Kurds during negotiations over the law.
We have been suffering from oil. Oil has always been used by the central government and salt. Weapons were bought through that oil, and we were killed by those weapons. So we hate the oil, we hate the weapon, we have centralism. We want things to be decentralized, and we have all the right to ask for regional involvement in the issue, to ask for guarantees, to ask for a share that would satisfy our demands and our area, because we have been suffering so much from that oil.
Sunni parties that walked out of the government earlier this week are also opposed to the law, complaining it is too vague on issues of how the oil will be sold and how revenues will be shared between the different governorates. In Baghdad, I'm David Enders for FSRN.
Congress is framing their message as they work to finish up a series of bills before they head back to their states for their summer recesses. Democrats are labeling Republicans as obstructionists, and Republicans are calling Democrats ineffective. As Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports, consensus is even difficult to reach on when and how to adjourn for the summer.
Indicative of how Congress has conducted much of its business recently, disagreements have caused both the House and the Senate to stand in temporary recess for most of the day. The House couldn't resolve a vote discrepancy, which caused the Republicans to boycott last night. Anger and accusations flew across the aisle, questioning motives and intentions. And over in the Senate, they stood in recess on how to proceed on reform of surveillance tools, or FISA. No compromise between the Democratic and the administration proposals could be reached. So in both chambers, Democrats and Republicans were unable to reach agreement. Friday's actions are especially noted on a day when both parties are attempting to frame their message for the month they'll spend with their constituents back home. Especially important for Democrats, the first major tally point since they'd gained control of Congress in January.
I think when you look back at the do-nothing Congresses, certainly the last 2 years and before, we can show that with a thin majority and with the obstructionism of the Republicans, we've accomplished a lot. We have a lot more to do, but our members will go home at the end of this week with a feeling of accomplishment and challenge to make sure that we do even more in the closing months of this session.
Assistant Leader Richard Durbin boasts of their accomplishments, an increase in the minimum wage and the 9/11 recommendations, the only two bills to be signed into law. The other two that are ready for the president's signature are lobby and ethics reform and a bill to increase math and science education. But Democrats have a longer list of things they've been unable to pass: immigration, union organizing, and an end to the war in Iraq. They blame Republicans, who in the Senate have been successful in forcing 60 votes on legislation they don't approve, instead of the normal, simple majority. Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell provides this explanation.
We're not in the majority here. What we have done is say to the Democrats and to the American people, when the majority is right, we will try to help them.
The rhetoric is ramped up so high that, in fact, neither side can allow the other side any sort of victory, even the perception of a victory.
Richard Holtzman is political science professor at Bryant College in Rhode Island.
And therefore, you know, the idea of working with the other side to get things done is sort of onerous to both parties.
The number one issue to many voters is still Iraq. Despite Democrats' attempts to make some changes, the war has only escalated since they've come to power. But Democrats insist that voters know that it's not their fault, that voters understand they can't bring the war to an end without the help of Republicans. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid.
I think voters understand how hard we've worked. Some of my people told me that they've watched a number of focus groups around the country, and with rare exception, people know how hard we've tried. Keeping in mind that Senator Johnson being sick, our majority doesn't exist. It's 50-49, we're the 49.
But David Swanson, founder of AfterDowningStreet.org, says many progressives have been extremely disappointed, saying the Democrats don't need the Republicans to change war policy.
To end the occupation of Iraq, all that's needed is for Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid tomorrow to announce there will be no more bills to fund the occupation of Iraq. The president has far more than the money needed to safely bring every troop and mercenary and contractor home, and is going to have to do so or fund this war illegally because there will be no more bills. And they would accomplish what the public, the majority of the public, and overwhelmingly the Democratic voters are demanding.
If they finish up their legislative business this weekend, which at airtime was still unpredictable, Congress will next meet in September, where Iraq is expected to take center stage. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The 2008 presidential election has gotten some concerned attention from around the world this week, while some of the first GLBT political leaders are announcing their presidential picks. Ingrid Drake has more with this week's Political News Roundup.
The government of Pakistan has criticized Democratic presidential candidate Senator Barack Obama, who said President Musharraf won't crack down on al-Qaeda activities inside Pakistan. Obama would not hesitate to order unilateral military action.
If we have actionable intelligence about high-value terrorist targets and President Musharraf will not act, we will.
Senator Obama's campaign was endorsed this week by Reverend Gene Robinson, New Hampshire's Episcopal bishop, who is gay, the same day as lesbian Wisconsin Congresswoman Tammy Baldwin endorsed Senator Hillary Clinton. Former Tennessee Senator Republican Fred Thompson has not announced his candidacy, but he has raised $3 million, far less than the $44 million accumulated by one of the Republican leading candidates from Massachusetts, Mitt Romney. Thompson speaking of his presidential priorities.
We also have the highest tax rates for corporations, anybody in the world, that's hampering our competitiveness.
The Associated Press reported that Florida's optical scan voting machines can be easily tampered with. Florida's Secretary of State is giving the Diebold Company until August 17th to address the system's numerous vulnerabilities. California Secretary of State Deborah Bowen decides today whether to ban electronic voting machines from Diebold, Sequoia, and Hart for next February's presidential primary, after recent tests by her office showed they were easily hacked. The Democratic National Committee announced a 50-state election protection effort with attorneys and a nationwide survey of localities' voting practices, such as voter databases and polling sites, before the 2008 election. Republican candidates are debating this weekend in Iowa, and next week Democratic candidates will gather in Chicago for the AFL-CIO's Presidential Candidates Forum. For this week's Political News Roundup, this is Ingrid Drake reporting in Washington, D.C.
The Mexican Army has stepped up its counterinsurgency operations ahead of this weekend's legislative elections in the southern state of Oaxaca. Hundreds of soldiers raided houses overnight in the Mexico City shanty suburb of Ciudad Neza in search of leftist guerrillas. Ciudad Neza is home to a large community of Oaxacans who have migrated to work in the Mexican capital. Meanwhile, Army Special Forces have been sent to Oaxaca to patrol public plazas, stores, and churches in the run-up to Sunday's elections for the state's legislative assembly. This is a high-level delegation from Amnesty International is in Mexico to urge the federal government to take action against political violence in Oaxaca that has so far stagnated in impunity. FSRN's Vladimir Flores files this report.
A report released this week by Amnesty International entitled Oaxaca Clamor for Justice documents multiple cases of unsolved political assassinations and scores of arbitrary arrests of people involved in anti-government protests in the state of Oaxaca. Amnesty International Secretary General Irene Khan is speaking at the press conference after hearing 3 hours of testimony from victims of political violence in the state.
The abuse of the police is so blatant that it is simply not enough to say that an inquiry has been opened and that victims are being summoned to testify. Impunity remains total, and the state has simply ignored the gravity of the abuses, despite very clear evidence, despite videotapes, despite photographs which you, the media, have taken. There is no information as to what action the authorities have taken to suspend the officials or to investigate the cases.
Later that same day, Khan met with Governor Ulises Ruiz, who belittled the findings of the Amnesty International report and denied the existence of an ongoing political conflict. Governor Ulises Ruiz.
There is no conflict. The conflict was last year. We did not agree with the Amnesty International report. Those who authored the Amnesty International report include advisors of the APO. We asked the Secretary General to listen to other perspectives, to listen to the points of view from different areas of the government so that they aren't so partial and unilateral and so they can have a better vision.
The Amnesty International visit with the governor and his cabinet came less than 12 hours before an explosive device went off in a shopping center, damaging the entrance of a Sears department store. The EPR guerrilla group later claimed responsibility for the blast in a communique. The guerrilla says that attack is part of a national campaign to demand the physical presentation of 2 EPR militants who disappeared from Oaxaca City on May 25th of this year. The federal government of Mexico and the state government of Oaxaca deny holding either of the men in their prisons. The EPR maintains the 2 are in a clandestine military custody. Eulalia Amaya is the mother of Edmundo Reyes Amaya, one of the missing men at the heart of the new EPR sabotage campaign.
He had breakfast and then left to go out. From that day on, he never came back. I found out from the news on the radio because they mentioned an Edmundo Reyes Amaya, but I didn't think they were talking about my son. I hope they haven't already killed him. This is why I'm demanding that the government present my son so that I can see him, or that they give us news about where he is.
In the past month, the EPR has claimed responsibility for placing explosive devices along gas pipelines in two states in central Mexico. Late last week, they attacked the construction site of a prison in the neighboring state of Chiapas. Amnesty International's Irene Khan has warned that governmental failure to deal with the root causes of the conflict through institutional means will only fuel this type of activity.
An autocratic response plagued with human rights violations will only perpetuate a vicious cycle of abuse, violence, and unrest. An urgent action is needed to break that cycle.
Oaxaca's social movement is calling upon the electorate to punish the political parties of Governor Ulises Ruiz and President Felipe Calderón in state legislative elections on Sunday. For FSRN, I am Vladimir Flores in Oaxaca City.
The Sri Lankan governing majority has shrunk to a parliamentary minimum and is now on a warpath to crush the Tamil Tiger rebels in the island nation. And an ethnic Tamil minority party has just defected from the government. FSRN's Pania Manakavasagam reports from Sri Lanka.
A cabinet minister and four deputy ministers from the Ceylon Workers' Congress that represents minority Tamil tea and rubber plantation workers resigned yesterday from the government. It leaves the government with 113 seats in the 225-seat parliament, the minimum number required for a working majority, and comes as the island's fractured opposition seeks to build an alliance to topple it. R. Yogarajan is the vice president of the Ceylon Workers' Congress.
The Ceylon Workers' Congress is a political organization and we have been unacceptably humiliated by the government. Therefore, we defected from the majority coalition. I can't discuss the particular incident or reason for this. Our intention is to not negotiate with the government, but injustice has been done to us and that is what made us leave.
But Nimal Siripala de Silva, the key minister of the government, says the CWC's resignation will not affect the government. The government is enjoying the support of 25 opposition lawmakers who joined the ruling party earlier this year. Observers say this strength will not last long as the government is confronted with increasing displeasure of the people with the inflated prices of essential items such as powdered milk, fuel and bus fare. The ongoing war is also affecting the country's economy. Murugesu Chittambalam, a former politician, is the president of Vaunia Bar Association.
The CWC quitting the government is retarding the process of negotiations. There is nobody in the government who will give pressure to start negotiations. Therefore, the situation is now worse. The government loses its weight in parliament. It will lose its moral strength in the international world. A muddled pool has been made more muddled.
The government says the victory that it has achieved in the Eastern Theater of War from the rebels has helped a great deal to win the hearts of the people. Key ministers in the government hope the army will liberate the north as well in the near future. But the stalled peace process and the growing accusations from the international countries regarding the deteriorating human rights situation in the country paints a negative picture. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiya Manikavasagam in Vamuniya, Sri Lanka.
A new report says California families could face devastating medical expenses if they're not protected. The report by the California Budget Project and the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research urges changes in the health care reform proposals now being considered in Sacramento. Christopher Martinez reports.
Legislative leaders and Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger say they want to enact comprehensive health care reform this year, but a new report says any reform will need safeguards to make sure it creates a health system people can actually afford to use. The California Budget Project and the UCLA Center for Health Policy have released a report on how much families can afford to pay for health care. The report includes recommendations on how to make any health reform affordable to the people who use it. David Carroll of the California Budget Project is a co-author of the report.
A necessary part of health care reform is ensuring that families have health care that they can actually use and that they can realistically afford along with their other basic living expenses. And in the midst of complicated health reform discussions, we shouldn't lose sight of what families can realistically afford to pay for health care.
The report says healthcare proposals being considered at the state capital raise questions about how much families can afford for healthcare. According to the report, most families with an income twice the federal poverty level already cannot afford to spend more on healthcare. Families with three times the federal poverty level would still need help to pay for health insurance premiums and other out-of-pocket expenses like copays. The Democratic health proposal, AB 8, and a proposal by Governor Schwarzenegger that has not been introduced as a bill, include some subsidies for low-income families, but the report says those may not be enough. The report also calls for limits on out-of-pocket costs. Co-author Gerald Kaminsky of the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research says current private health insurance plans do not have a limit on their out-of-pocket costs.
This is one of the reasons why there are so many personal bankruptcies in the United States for people who are already insured. Despite their insurance, they can still, as our studies show, have large expenditures because of the out-of-pocket responsibility and the lack of limits on out-of-pocket spending.
In July, the House Judiciary Committee held a special hearing in Washington, D.C. on medical-related bankruptcies. Harvard Law School bankruptcy expert Elizabeth Warren told the committee the current healthcare system is bankrupting middle-class families, with an estimated 5 million families filing for bankruptcies after medical problems since the year 2000. Anthony Wright is with Health Access, a health reform advocacy group. He says California is having an exciting healthcare debate, and he calls the new report an important piece of the conversation. He says the debate needs to include a broad discussion of how much it will cost people, not only in health insurance premiums.
Equally as important is how much the coverage is to use. What are the copays? What are the deductibles? What are the overall out-of-pocket cost maximums? Because at the end of the day, that's what's going to enable people to be able to use the coverage they have.
On the State Capitol Beat, I'm Christopher Martinez.
And now, from his cell on Pennsylvania's death row, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The flood of bad press about the southern African nation of Zimbabwe has filled the writer with ambivalence. Tales of government repression, violence against pro-democracy activists, charges of corruption against the Mugabe regime, and the dire deterioration of the economy have combined to paint an unflattering portrait of the nation. Yet two things stayed my hand. One, consideration of the source, and two, the knowledge that until Robert Mugabe began demanding return of tens of thousands of hectares of land stolen by whites to African farmers, he was hailed as a hero in the West. In much of this bad press, I noticed that something vitally important was missing, the criminal fact that a tiny, wealthy white minority, some 1% of the population, owned about 75% of the land, while the African majority barely survive on scraps of land. Those stolen lands have led to vast stores of wealth, white wealth, and black impoverishment, for land is the basis of wealth, even stolen land. Even today, tobacco is one of Zimbabwe's chief cash crops, but that cash goes to white landowners who sock their dough away to Britain or the U.S. The clamor for human rights and democracy? It sounds hollow after the debacle in Iraq. Are we to believe that the U.S. cares about human rights in Zimbabwe when they still don't give a damn about human rights in New Orleans, where Africans have been living for at least 200 years? This ain't about democracy. It ain't about human rights. It's about globalization as the new face of colonialism and the continued exploitation of Africa for foreign interests. Democracy and human rights is but the latest Trojan horse. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Abogado.